There is something of a class conflict going on in American politics, but it's not quite what you probably expect. What am I talking about? Well, you will see and or hear. Keith Preston is here to address the issue tonight. Very glad to have him here. It's going to be an issue that has immense relevance to the 2024 election and well beyond. We get into the stuff on this episode of Newsite. I'm your host, Joseph Cotto. Keith, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be back. Been a while.
Yeah, it has been too long, but glad that you are here and very glad to discuss this. It's important stuff. Now, there was an article published in Jacobin Magazine titled Debating Class Dealignment. This was published on March 10th. And it says, Class Dealignment posits that Democrats have been losing working class voters in favor of middle and upper class voters. Is this actually happening? And to what extent is it a problem? And I will read the beginning of the article. It goes, a specter is haunting socialist politics, the specter of the Brahmin left. The renowned political economist Thomas Piketty, with Amory Geithen and Clara Martinez Toledano, discussed this group in an influential 2022 research paper on political cleavages in Western democracies since the mid-20th century. This group is referring to highly educated voters, typically employed in professional occupations, whose allegiance to center-left and left-wing parties has grown in recent decades. By calling them Brahmins, Piketty and his collaborators likened them to the religious figures and intellectuals who occupied an elite position in India's traditional caste system. In their framework, these educational elites of the rich capitalist world face off against an economic elite they call the merchant right, while the needs of the vast majority go unacknowledged and unmet. Faced with such a dismal choice, working class voters are either dropping out of politics entirely or shifting their allegiances from the left to the right. This process of class dealignment has become a staple of analysis and commentary across the political spectrum, including the socialist left. It's clear that electoral patterns in rich capitalist democracies have changed, in some cases rather dramatically since the post-war years. But it's not always clear what exactly is happening in electoral politics, nor why, or what socialists could do to shift political conflict onto a more favorable terrain. I'll stop reading there. And for those who don't know, I just assume people know at this point, but come to think of it, a lot of folks probably don't know, unfortunately. Keith is an academic. He is an anarchist, and he is someone who teaches sociology at the college level. So his perspective here is very welcome indeed. And he also has a website. Keith, would you mind telling people where they can find your stuff?
Sure. If you want to know more about me, just go to attackthesystem.com, attackthesystem.com, just like it sounds. There you can find links to some of my books and other online published material and other stuff by our members in our collective and contributors as well.
And you are on Twitter and Facebook, I believe, right?
I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, not sure what else.
Got it. Where can people find you on Twitter?
My name is T. Keith Preston. My full name is Troy Keith Preston. I've gone by my middle name since I was a child, but my name is Troy Keith Preston. I'm T. Keith Preston on Twitter, and I'm also Troy Preston or Troy K. Preston on Facebook.
Got it. So now, Keith, what do you think about the introduction to this Jacobin Magazine article?
Yeah, well, the study that they're citing that was conducted by Thomas Piketty and his associates some years ago is, well, really not that long ago. I think it came out maybe in 2022, I believe it said. But that particular study is a landmark study, because what they did was they examined class voting patterns in 22 Western democracies. That is how people vote based on their class position. And what they found was that there was a near universal pattern. It was most pronounced in the United States, but it was a near universal pattern in the Western world, where we see this divide emerging between what they call the Brahmin left and the merchant right. The Brahmin left is what is sometimes referred to in other social science literature as the professional managerial class, or simply the elite of the world of education, management, the public sector, the professions, things like that, as well as the newly rich, that is people who have become wealthy through the tech industry and some of the other newer industries. This is what Piketty is referring to when he talks about the Brahmin left, because these people tend to be upwardly mobile, affluent, upper middle class, even rich in some instances, but they tend to side with the left politically. And there's a range of reasons for that. They tend to be more socially liberal. They tend to be more pro-environmentalism. They tend to be more culturally cosmopolitan. They tend to be more ethnically diverse. They tend to be more gender diverse. So for that reason, we see a lot of people from the affluent classes moving leftward politically. At the same time, we see more people who would in the past have voted for the left, that is members of the traditional working class who were members of labor unions and would vote for social democratic economic programs. Those people increasingly are moving to the right in many Western countries. So the alignment that we see is that we see the left and the upper middle class coming together on one side of the fence. And then we see the working class and the merchant right, which is just a euphemism for the business class, particularly the more medium to small business class. We see that increasingly becoming aligned on the right, which is fairly interesting. And I do think that there's a wide range of reasons that explain why this is happening. One reason is simply the changes that have taken place in modern economies. And we can compare it in some ways to the 19th century. For instance, in the 19th century, there was a very there was a time of very rapid economic and technological and social change generated by the Industrial Revolution. And what you saw was that traditional societies were starting to break down, that is the traditional monarchies, feudal systems, aristocracies, established churches, all of these kinds of things were breaking down. And you had a new class of what the Marxists called the bourgeoisie or the capitalist class or whatever. What had been previously a middle class or a merchant class essentially became the dominant class. And that really created a lot of the basis for modern societies that are very commercially driven, and where bankers and merchants and businessmen and people like that are the dominant social class. Something similar to that has happened with the digital economy, with the changes that have taken place as a result of the tech revolution. We've seen a whole new class of entrepreneurs, tech oligarchs, if you want to call them, people who are newly rich, that is people who are not from the traditional upper class, like say the Rockefellers or something like that, but people who are first generation rich or second generation rich have come along, and because they've made a lot of money in the tech industries or some of these newer industries. Also, we've seen an expanded professional class. As societies have become more complex, we've seen more societies expand their professional class in part just out of practical need. We see a larger public sector. We see more people who have education, advanced education, like university degrees or even graduate or postgraduate degrees. So we see this new elite class that's replacing the older elites. We see that the traditional merchant class is in some ways being eclipsed by this newly rich class of these new tech entrepreneurs or hedge fund managers that have that are the result of financialization of these things. And we see that this there's been a growth in the new middle class of professionals and managers, even while the traditional middle class of, say, white-collar workers or high-wage blue-collar workers have started to decline. So these sectors that are in decline are have moved towards each other, whereas these rising sectors have also moved towards each other. And it's very similar to the 19th century, where you had a lot of people who were losing their livelihoods, even as a lot of rapid technological and economic innovation was happening at the same time. In the 19th century, you had small farmers who were losing their lands, that were migrating towards cities to get jobs in factories. You had artisans and craftsmen who were being put out of business by new technologies. And a lot of those ended up having to go to work in factories. That's where we get what the Marxists call the proletariat. And a very similar process is unfolding in the early 21st century is what happened in the 19th century, where we have a new ruling class emerging, at least in the economic realm. And we have other people who are on the losing end of that. And this class realignment that the Jacobin magazine article is talking about and that the Piketty study mentioned reflects that.
The change happening is wide-ranging, to say the absolute least. There are several things you brought up that are worth going over. But one interesting thing, I think perhaps the most interesting thing, is how tech has driven the well-to-do leftward. This is absolutely the case. And that's not to say all people who make their money from tech are left-wingers. As a matter of fact, there's some very prominent examples of people who are not. But on the whole, the more tech-driven economy and the jobs that is produced, not just for the wealthy, but for what could broadly be defined as the middle class, that definitely has pushed some in the middle class leftward. It has created a situation in which the well-to-do especially turn leftward. It's bizarre because it seems the wealthier people are in the tech industry, the more likely they are to be left-leaning. Although that's a very broad statement. I'll say that once again, there are plenty of exceptions to the rule. But anyhow, Keith, why more than anything else do you think that tech has driven the well-to-do leftward?
Well, I think it's a convergence of factors that are happening at the same time. One of those is we have to consider demographic change. Western societies are experiencing demographic change through things like immigration, where the number of people that belong to minority ethnic groups are becoming larger in number. And typically people who are ethnic minorities tend to lean leftward because they tend to see the left as the party of civil rights and things of that nature, or non-discrimination. Also, we see generational change. We see a new generation of people coming up who are not particularly influenced by some of the same value systems that influence older generations. They've grown up in the post-1968 era. Some of them have grown up in the in the 21st century, and for them, the 20th century itself is old news. Their cultural orientation is much different than what it may have been for a few generations ago. So we see demographic change, generational change, and cultural change, of course. We see a lot of change in cultural norms. One thing that we see is that the number of educated and upwardly mobile women has increased significantly as well. And in fact, we see a gender divide between young men and young women. We see that on average, young women are much more likely to be college educated and upwardly mobile and to lean politically leftward, whereas young men are more likely to be experiencing a state of decline socioeconomically relative to the generations before them, are less likely to be college educated, are more likely to be downwardly mobile, and are more likely to be rightward leaning politically. That's another interesting phenomenon. A big part of this has to do with the educational system. One of the key indicators as to whether a person will vote for the left or for the right in an election is whether they have a university degree. Right? So those who have been through the educational, the higher educational system are much more likely to be on the political left. We have to remember that the system of higher education, at least in the fields that are most relevant to politics and social issues and things like that, tend to be very left-leaning in many instances. So they're more likely to have been educated in a way that emphasized more left-wing values or ideological principles than someone who has not been through the university system. That's another thing. Also, one of the main divides in politics today is, in fact, between what are called knowledge workers and virtually everyone else. That is, if someone makes their living in one of the knowledge industries, or what I call the ideas industries, whether they work in tech or in media, journalism, education, law, entertainment, the social services, human resources, if they work in these ideas industries, these knowledge workers, they are more likely to be left-leaning than virtually any other occupational sector or demographic sector or cultural sector. So all of these factors converge and then reinforce each other. And there, out of that, you get the phenomena that the Jackman Magazine article is talking about, where you have this Brahmin left of educated, upwardly mobile people who are, you know, professional people, but who lean leftward politically, whereas you have other folks who are perhaps more downwardly mobile or more traditional in terms of, you know, or come from more traditional economic sectors in terms of how they make their living, and lean rightward. And we also have to remember that parallel to a lot of the technological change and economic change we're talking about is social change. Again, that was the case in the 19th century as well, when I was talking about that earlier. In the 19th century, you saw very rapid social change. You saw organized religion decline in influence. You saw the rise of science and technology and on unprecedented levels. You saw egalitarian political or civic norms becoming more commonplace, things like abolishing slavery, giving women the right to vote, all of these kinds of things. And we've seen the same thing happen in more recent times as well. We've seen a lot of unprecedented social and cultural things, cultural changes, like gay marriage, for example, or the mainstreaming of the transgender phenomena, or the increasing influence of environmentalists. Yeah, these were things that weren't issues just a few decades ago. So that, I think that's another part of this. So all of these factors are converging: cultural, social, economic, technological, political, demographic factors are converging to make this situation what it is, where we have this alliance between the Brahmin left, the Brahmin class and the left on one hand, and then the merchant class and the traditional working class on the other.
There is something else you brought up, which actually is relevant to some stuff you were just mentioning now. I mean, you brought this up earlier. The expanded professional class is something which boosts the left. And that's counterintuitive, because many would have thought that the expansion of the professional class would boost the right, because obviously people are part of the professional class. They earn above average salaries, and then they would be able to use that money to invest in one thing or another. They have skin in the game of the economy. So the thinking would go, these people would naturally be more conservative to support their economic interests. But the opposite has happened, as you noted. So why do you think the expansion of the professional class has, in the West, boosted the left, especially in the United States?
Well, substantial numbers of persons who were part of the professional managerial class, which is the another term for the Brahmin left. Thomas Piketty coined the term Brahmin left. The professional managerial class was coined by Barbara Ehrenreich, who was a left-wing journalist. She died a few years ago, but she's the one that coined that. But the two terms mean practically the same thing. And both Ehrenreich and Piketty are on the left politically. But the reason you would see members of the professional class or managerial class or even the new tech elites leaning leftward is, first of all, many of them have careers and occupations that are, in fact, dependent on government subsidies or contracts or government jobs. A whole lot of professional people make their living working for the government, or they work for private businesses that receive much of their income and much of their business from government agencies. That's a big part of it. You know, whether you're a lawyer, whether you are some sort of administrator in a civil service agency, some sort of public agency, a social service agency, whether you are in the education field. If you are in the education field, chances are you work for either the public school system, or you work for a public university, or you work for a private university that's heavily dependent on income generated by student loans and things like that. Many private companies do the bulk of their businesses with the government. Others are dependent on government subsidies and research grants and all kinds of things like that. So the idea that members of the professional managerial class would be anti-government is not likely once you understand the dynamics of how that whole economic framework works. In the past, you would see people of high income or upward mobility being on the right in the sense that they mostly owned businesses of their own, or they were upwardly mobile private sector workers. They were white collar workers in the private sector. You know, an accountant that works for a big corporation or something like that, like General Motors or whatever. And mostly an upwardly mobile person of that kind, a high income person of that kind, they want to keep their taxes low. They want to keep their businesses from being regulated too heavily. They don't want policies that are going to impede economic growth and development. They don't want inflationary monetary policies. And that's why people from the business sector and private sector workers, at least high income private sector workers, white collar type workers, that's why they tend to lean rightward politically. They tend to be more sympathetic to what's commonly called free market economics or hand government deregulation of business and lower taxes and things of that nature. But the members of this new upper middle class of professional people, of administrative workers, managers, people who are in all of these ideas industries, they are not nearly as dependent on the private sector as some of their predecessors or some of their opponents. They tend to be much more dependent on the public sector. In terms of something, like I said, some of them work directly for the government. Some of them are in professions that are government oriented. Some of them are in businesses that are heavily subsidized or get a lot of contracts with the government. So they're in economic fields and in occupations and in industries would have a much different relationship with government than what you might find in some of their competitors.
That's fascinating. It's definitely worth having brought up. I'm glad that you did. Of course, I think if one works for the government, this person would be wise to still want a vigorous private sector because the government won't have any money to pay its employees or launch various programs, if not for the private sector. That's where the revenue comes from. Obviously, the government does not create the economy. But I think a lot of people who are dependent upon the government for employment or for funding don't think this through.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, most of the people we're talking about are not economists. You know, they're not looking at it from that vantage point. For instance, we talk about a lot when we talk about all kinds of potential economic policies. A lot of these more upwardly mobile people that we're describing today are much more inclined to be in favor of public health care, more inclined to favor something like single payer health care. And they are also more inclined to favor something like student loan debt forgiveness for the simple reason that they have very exorbitant student loan debts in many instances, and it's difficult to make the payments. So naturally they want to vote for political candidates that would promise student loan debt forgiveness or universal health care, things like that. Someone who's more private sector oriented would probably, first of all, be less likely to have an exorbitant student loan debt. They probably work for a company perhaps where they have health care benefits there. Or if they don't, they'd be more concerned about being able to afford private insurance. So the set of economic incentives are different. Of course, on a macro level, you could say, well, what if any of these policies are good for the economy as a whole? But most people aren't really thinking about it in that way. They're just simply thinking about, well, what's going to benefit their own pocketbook in the short term? Would they rather have tax cuts and deregulation? Would they rather have public health care, student loan debt forgiveness, or increased social benefits, higher social security premiums? And that's what drives a lot of this conflict.
For sure. Absolutely. A lot of it does have to do with short-term thinking. That's obvious. Now, there's something else you brought up, the new middle class. That's fascinating because obviously the middle class is going through a shift. The middle class in this country is, generally speaking, in decline, but there is, I would not say a surplus, but there are quite a few jobs that have popped up that provide people with a middle-class-like existence, or you could say an outright middle-class existence. Interestingly, these jobs of the new middle class require education that a generation, certainly two generations before, the educational level required would have been thought of as something for the higher echelons of society. But, that's a whole nother matter in and of itself. But the fact of the matter is that the rise of the new middle class definitely has influenced politics as something that pushes folks who might be called upwardly mobile leftward. And I think a big part of the reason is education. A lot of these people have student loan debt, and that debt prevents them from really saving for the future and planning for the future. I read a study on a previous episode, and it shows that a lot of millennials and I believe Zoomers don't have much thought at all when it comes to their financial future. They don't make plans for the future. They live on credit. They basically further their debt, and they do so because it feels good. That's more or less the strategy of a lot of people under 45, and it does look like it's going to stop anytime soon. So obviously, people with this strategy would want or expect public policy that is aligned with their behavior, with their life expectations. And they would say that they're in this situation because their student debt makes it so there's no point really in planning for the future because the debt controls their life. But the fact of the matter is not everybody has to get into that level of debt. Most people actually do not. Most people in America don't have a college degree. And even if you do have a college degree, you don't have to have that level of debt. There are ways, approaches too complicated to get into here, but I've certainly taken those approaches and it works out quite nicely. But, a lot of people don't. But anyway, the rise of the new middle class and its politics absolutely are worth bringing up. Any thoughts on the matter, Keith?
Yeah, well, there's this question of how you go about defining what the middle class is. The traditional European meaning of the term middle class was the merchant class. That is somebody who is not a titled aristocrat or a member of royalty, but somebody who is a merchant or a banker or perhaps a large landowner, but not nobility. That kind of person was considered middle class in traditional societies. In an American context, middle class is typically thought of as somebody that has an average income or something like that, which is a fairly arbitrary way of defining middle class, but that is how it's viewed by Americans on average. But the the composition of the so-called middle class in the United States has certainly changed. In the post-war period, from roughly the end of World War II up through almost the end of the 20th century, for the first time in history, the United States had a working class that could live about like an upper middle class, a traditional upper middle class, in terms of consumption and lifestyle and all of that. And that was fairly unique to the United States. It existed to some degree in Europe and maybe a few other places, but for the most part, it was an American phenomenon that happened in the post-war period, the post-war economic boom, when the United States controlled half the world's economy. And in that time period, we had a working class that experienced tremendous upward mobility because working people, wage earners, hourly wage earners, were able to get jobs in factories and in industrial facilities where they were essentially blue-collar workers. But their wages were unprecedentedly high, and they earned enough income where they were able to buy their own homes and a car and sometimes multiple cars and have household appliances because we saw a very rapid technological expansion during the same time. And that's how you saw the explosion of suburban life in the post-war period. You started to see the proliferation of suburbs and single family homes, you know, with the stereotype of a nuclear family, you know, man, wife, two or three children, the dog, et cetera, and with a car and with a washing machine and all of that kind of stuff. And that was sort of what the middle class was thought to be for, you know, a good part of the mid to late 20th century. But since then, in the era of globalization, in the era of financialization, in the era of the digital revolution, we've started to see that type of middle class, which is really just an upwardly mobile working class. We've seen that type of middle class decline. It's much more difficult to aspire to that kind of way of life nowadays. But what we have seen instead is the rise of what I've been talking about, which is the knowledge sector, the ideas industries. And that kind of work requires college education in a way that, say, you know, being an auto worker in Detroit or something in the 1960s would not have. So more and more people are having to go to college to get the credentials necessary for these kinds of professions. And college, parallel to that, has become increasingly expensive. In the 1960s, you could go to some universities with a tuition payment of $100 a semester, which would be unthinkable nowadays. You can't even go to one of these online degree mills for that nowadays. And so as college has become more necessary for upward mobility, more and more people are going to college. At the same time, college has become more expensive. So in turn, people are taking out these student loan debts. And the whole student loan system has become a type of almost indentured servitude because student loan debt tends to be very exorbitant and has a very high interest rate. It's also not dischargeable in personal bankruptcy. So if you accumulate a student loan debt, it's pretty much with you for life until you pay it off. So more and more people are going to college and accumulating these kinds of debts. And what we're seeing now is the growth of a debtor class that's sort of a middle, a medium level debtor class. We're starting to see more and more of these kinds of people as part of the economy and who are burdened with all of the student loan debt. And parallel to that, we start to see that a rising cost for virtually everything else. We see that healthcare is increasingly expensive. We see housing now is very expensive. It's virtually like it used to be, for example, that if you aspired to be an upwardly mobile middle class person for a while, your goal might be to make, when I was a kid, it would have been maybe $50,000 a year. When I was a young adult, it was probably more like $100,000 a year. Nowadays, it's more like $200,000 a year. Like if you want to be a reasonably upwardly mobile person, say in any large metropolitan area in the United States or even by other places, you probably need about $200,000 a year in income to buy a house and make car payments and pay for your student loans and pay for your medical insurance and all of the things you're expected to have. And increasingly, many people are unable to do that. Many people are basically permanent debtors. You know, they're living a way of life where they're simply not able to afford these things. For instance, I've known people who were relatively young, you know, people with relatively high income professional jobs, and their entire paycheck would go for their student loan payment and their rent. And everything else that they did was basically paid for through some kind of debt or another, usually credit cards, sometimes personal loans. Sometimes if they owned a house, it was they would refinance the house several times. And of course, along the way, they're accumulating six-figure debts. So even if they've got a, you know, $150,000 a year income, they've got $450,000 in personal debt. And more people who are technically considered middle class or even upper middle class or have this kind of financial situation. In fact, I'd say at this point is practically the norm among people from that generation and that income level. Now, it's certainly true that there are people, as you were saying, that make a good income that do not have, say, big student loan debts. Increasingly, you see people who are self-employed in the gig economy who make a fairly decent income just as freelancers and things like that. That's certainly true. But the whole model of what it means to be a middle class person in the United States or in Europe has really changed dramatically.
Absolutely. It's interesting because the most important thing is not one's income. It's one's quality of life. And the truth of the matter is, if there is someone who, say, a police officer or a firefighter or an EMT who earns, let's just say, on average, $50,000 to $60,000 a year, and this person has no debt, that person is living far better than someone who makes $150,000 a year working as a financial analyst. But that person has a hopeless situation when it comes to paying back what they took out in loans to get that MBA from a top-tier school. So it's interesting. It is. Income only tells part of the story. Certainly that firefighter, policeman, EMT is going to have a much less depressing and aggravating lifestyle. I mean, they're stressful jobs notwithstanding. So it's really interesting how one chooses to view the situation of personal wealth versus personal income, because obviously as well, these workers who did something, who are in fields that do not require this expensive college degree, they're going to be able to save up for their retirement as long as they don't get themselves into debts for reasons that nothing to do with education, but they're going to be able to save up for their retirement to a much greater degree than that financial analyst who earns about three times as much as they do.
Yeah, I think that's true. And although increasingly the base level cost of living is going up quite a bit. For instance, if you make $50,000 or $60,000 a year, that's considered about median income right now. I think median income is currently considered maybe $52,000 a year, $56,000, something like that. But if you're living in New York City and you're paying two-thirds of that for rent, you're still not doing very well financially. Assuming you can work it with your professional or employment situation, you can always relocate to a place where perhaps the cost of living is lower. But it's also true that all of these other essential services and goods are becoming more expensive as well. So it's the case that people in the public and private sector are struggling to a greater degree. You know, people who are financially successful or reasonably financially successful and don't have debt still have to deal with higher inflation rates. They have to deal with the higher cost of healthcare, housing, all of these other things. So the situation with a whole lot of working class to middle class people is deteriorating in terms of their ability to maintain a high standard of living. notwithstanding the rise of this expanded professional class.
It is something else. One of the good things about being, you know, an EMT, a firefighter, a policeman, a security officer, whatever, is that they get a certification, which typically, as far as I'm aware, in every state, allows them to work statewide. So they have that licensure, and it would mean that they have the ability to move from a very expensive area to a less expensive area. And the jobs, you know, will always be in demand for EMT, fire, police, security, so on and so forth. So these are things that are definitely, I mean, to be in any one of these professions definitely is an asset. If one has very prestigious education to do something very specific, like say being a financial analyst, those jobs are not the easiest to come by. They require you often to live in very expensive areas, especially now with remote work being on the decline. And AI poses a threat to your career longevity. There will never be such a thing as an AI fireman. So just it definitely is food for thought.
Well, certainly technological factors are important. Again, I was talking about the 19th century before. And when the Industrial Revolution came, one of the things that caused a lot of people to start losing their livelihoods was mechanization and the growth of factories and industrial machinery and the ability to mass produce things on assembly lines in ways that no longer required artisans and craftsmen. And you had also had mechanized agriculture, and that tended to put a lot of small farmers out of business. And often people reacted to this in a very hostile way. I mean, you actually had, you know, what today would be called terrorism, you know, where you had people that were losing their livelihoods, destroying you know, machinery and trying to blow up factories and stuff like that. That kind of stuff actually happened back in those days. We see something comparable today where you see more and more people who are losing their livelihoods to technology because technological change has made what they do for a living obsolete. One interesting example is in the music industry. The way that the music industry was set up, say in the 60s, 70s, 80s, perhaps, was you had record companies that, you know, made their money through selling recordings. And then they would put performers out on tour to do live performances and then the performances were used to promote the recordings. So the idea was if you're a record company, you'd send your recording artist out on tour, and then that would be used to promote the album that your artist had done. And that way people start buying your album, and whatever you spend on tour support, you're going to make back through album sales. That was sort of the business model for the recording industry in the mid to late 20th century. Well, when the internet came along, that totally destroyed that aspect of the music industry. You know, virtually everyone that works in recording today will say you can't make money off of recordings anymore. You know, that if you make if you're a recording artist, and I mean, yeah, you can, in the sense that you can still do things like Spotify and all that, but what you're going to make in terms of royalties or sales or whatever is going to be is going to pale in comparison to what was once the case, for the same reason that music is essentially available for free. Like in my particular case, I haven't bought music probably in years, maybe decades. You know, if there's some song or something I want to check out or want to hear, I'll just find it on YouTube, you know, and listen to it for free. And that's pretty much the norm. And of course, there are recording artists and music industry executives who complain about that. But unfortunately for them, that's the business model that has been generated as a result of technological changes. And that's true of other industries as well. For example, cabs, the advent of rideshare services like Uber and Lyft has undermined traditional cab services. You know, I've known cab drivers in large cities like New York and DC who hate and despise Uber and Lyft because they look at it like Uber is cutting into their business, and they're right, because what happened is that the technological changes, like the invention of iPhones and then apps and stuff like that, created a technological framework where new business models could be developed, like ride sharing, which many people prefer to traditional cab services because they're either cheaper, more convenient, or offer better service or whatever. So a lot of cab drivers have been put out of business as a result of that. And there's many other industries that are comparable. Another one is people who work in retail checkout. You know, nowadays, more and more retail stores, supermarkets, places like that have these self-checkout systems. And that reduces the need for cashiers. You know, increasingly, if you go to a Target or Walmart or something like that, you know, you may see a few cashiers, sure, but you're also going to see a lot of checkout, self-checkout systems, and that reduces the need for cashiers. So you have less jobs available, you know, for, I mean, that's a low-income service industry job, but it's still a job. And so those kinds of jobs have declined. And technology is having that effect throughout the economy. And that in turn influences the kinds of life choices and options that people have. You know, I mean, for better or worse, like one thing that internet technology has allowed for is for more and more people to become remote workers or freelancers or digital nomads, you know, so they can work for online while they travel or work from home and things like that. So there's, you know, it provides more opportunities in some ways, and then there's losses in other ways.
Absolutely. It's interesting that obviously a lot of companies now are rolling back their work from home policies, or they're not hiring new workers from home. But the work from home revolution, which came about during COVID, it was already in place before COVID, but it greatly accelerated during COVID, I should say. That is something which cannot, it's the genie that cannot be put back in the bottle. Even if work from home is being curtailed, it will never be as infrequent as it was pre-COVID. And like I said, already pre-COVID, it was much more frequent than it had been half a decade, let alone a decade beforehand.
Yeah, well, it's harder, it's somewhat harder for employers to maintain labor discipline with remote workers, because you're not there watching what your workers are doing. And you know, that's also true for other remote services like remote learning. During the pandemic, when a lot of K through 12 students were going to school online, they were doing their classes online, obviously it was harder to maintain, for students to maintain academic discipline. Like I know in my own experience, because I am, I teach university students, when COVID happened and all of my classes went online, I did see a sharp decline in the quality of the work the students were doing, because a lot of students at the time just didn't seem to take online classes seriously. They thought that they weren't real classes if we didn't go to a classroom, and they thought they didn't need to do assignments, that, you know, somehow an exam is just a volunteer effort or something like that. And I think that at the K through 12 level, it was probably even more of an issue. And the same is true with employers. I mean, the maintenance of labor discipline with work at home employees is going to be problematic. And you have to be able to counter that, obviously. You have to, like I know in my own professional life, I have been a freelancer where I'm essentially self-employed. But that doesn't mean I get to just do whatever I want. It means that I still have to meet certain quotas of productivity to get the results that I want. Yeah, some people are able to discipline themselves in that way and some aren't. But it is a problem if you're trying to manage an organization of people who are all working at home in that way. So I suspect that's the reason that many employers have tried to curtail remote working. Also, there's a communication problem. It's easier to have a team meeting in a meeting room and at the office than it is to try to get a bunch of people on a Zoom call or something like that. So all of these problems can be, all of these issues present logistical problems when it comes to management.
Absolutely. And those problems aren't going away. Most people tend to be followers rather than leaders, so they have to be shepherded. And working from home, like being educated from home, is very self-directed, although it works great for many, many people. If it weren't for instance, education, remote education, I never would have receive my college degrees. So, you know, remote work does work, whether you're talking about educational work or career-based work or both, but it does not work for everyone. It's just one of those things where a lot of people are not self-directed enough to get the job done. Now, Keith, I'm going to bring up a few interesting stats here about the working class in American politics, and I think you might find it to be of interest. These stats are coming from an article written by Rui Teixeira, and the article is titled "The Non-White Working Class Bails Out on the Democrats." It was published on March 7th in his newsletter titled "The Liberal Patriot." There's so much here. Where does one start? Number one, Biden's job approval. Biden's job approval among the non-white working class is a dreadful 34%. Among white college graduates, it's a comparatively healthy 47%. The non-white working class is actually closer to the white working class's assessment of Biden, 28% approval, than to white college graduates' view of Biden. Number two, Trump favorability. Trump has a 44% favorability rating among non-white working class voters. That's lower than the 55% ratings among the white working class, but still closer to that rating than Trump's 29% favorability among white college graduates. Number three, personality and temperament to be an effective president. White and non-white working class voters are very close on the assessment of Biden. 42% versus 46% say Biden has what it takes to be an effective president. Way lower than the 63% thumbs up from white college grads. And on Trump's capabilities, the two working class sectors are almost identical. 48% versus 47% think Trump can do the job. Way higher than the 29% among white college voters who agree. Number four, assessments of the economy. About three-fifths, 59% of the non-white working class characterizes current economic conditions as poor. That's identical with views among the white working class and way more negative than among white college voters, only 38% of whom believe the economy is that bad. In terms of whether the economy is better or worse than a year ago, a mere 15% of non-white working class voters believe the economy has gotten better, while 51% believe it has gotten worse. That's close to white working class voters, where 21% say better and 42% say worse. But for white college graduates, views are much sunnier, 32% better and 29% worse. Looking back further, the non-white working class deems the economy worse rather than better than 4 years ago by 67% to 12%, quite similar to the white working class at 74% worse, 16% better. That compares to white college grads at 50% worse, 30% better. I will stop there. Keith, anything to say about these numbers that I brought up?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the article that you're citing. Writer that wrote that, Teixeira, he and John Judas had a book that was published about 20 years ago called The Emerging Democratic Majority, meaning the Democratic Party. And their prediction 20 years ago was that demographic change in the United States, like, for example, the increase in the number of people who are not white, being one of the main ones, would have the effect of giving the Democratic Party a permanent majority. And that's largely what happened in the sense that it was largely a major contributing factor to the election of Barack Obama. Also, when we look at electoral patterns even today, we see that the Republican Party has not won the popular vote in any presidential election since 1988, when George Bush Sr. beat Michael Dukakis. The only exception to that was in 2004, when George W. Bush beat John Kerry. And I think the clear reason for President Bush Jr.'s victory was he was seen better as being better on national security, which was a major issue, obviously, in 2004, because it wasn't that long after 9/11. We have seen that demographic, cultural, generational change has very much made against the Republican Party, and that remains true even today. Of course, as we know, President Trump lost re-election. He did not win the popular vote in the 2016 election. And typically speaking, the Democratic Party is the majority party now, at least by a slight margin. However, it's also true, as this article by Teixeira points out, that the Democratic Party, even while they are gaining among affluent and wealthy voters, is starting to lose among not only the working class generally, but among the non-white working class, particularly Blacks and Hispanics. And the question is, why is that? And I think the reasons are multifold. Some of it has to do with the same reasons why the Democrats are increasingly losing among white working class voters, because the Democrats are seen as increasingly a party of the elites, of urban, cosmopolitan, upwardly mobile, professional class people who are not in touch with working class needs or interests. It's also true that as the society becomes more integrated, for a lot of minorities, I think civil rights is less of a consideration. I mean, the main reason, obviously, why for a long time most minorities voted Democratic is because the Democrats were seen as a civil rights party. That is not quite as pressing of an issue as society becomes more and more integrated, more and more minorities become upwardly mobile. In fact, one reason why the upper middle class is moving leftward is because it's also becoming more demographically diverse. I touched on that a little bit before. But you also have a lot of minorities who are working class, who share the same concerns as white working class people, just in terms of economic considerations and things like that, but also other considerations. You have a lot of minority people who are working class or maybe not even working class, maybe upper to mobile, but who are socially conservative. For example, a lot of Hispanics tend to be devoutly Catholic, so they tend to oppose abortion for that reason. Or you have a lot of Blacks who are also very religious, who may be very evangelical or Protestant fundamentalist, and may also be against abortion or oppose gay marriage or something of that nature. So you have a lot of minorities who are religious conservatives or social conservatives. You have others that are more concerned with things like crime. Particularly poor to working class minorities are more likely to live in a neighborhood where there's a high crime rate. So they may be more conservative on crime issues. Or another issue is immigration. Immigration tends to be most damaging to lower income minorities because unskilled, undocumented workers are the primary competitors in some industries to native born but ethnic minority low income workers. So concerns about crime, immigration, religion, cultural norms, minorities may own small businesses. They may not want taxes or government regulation pertaining to their businesses. So there's a whole lot of reasons why you would see more minorities moving rightward politically, particularly as the wider society is becoming more integrated and things like civil rights are not as an immediate issue. It's not like we still have a world where politicians like George Wallace or Strom Thurmond, who were prominent politicians back in the mid-20th century, say they want to bring back segregation or something like that. That's not really on the table politically. So civil rights issues really just aren't that of a pressing issue for many minorities today in the way it would have been in past times. However, they may be more concerned about some of these other issues, economic issues, business issues, crime, immigration, religion, sexual morals, family values, all of these kinds of things that motivate people who are white and who are conservative.
I think you're absolutely correct. It's interesting because a lot of folks cannot fathom why minorities are increasingly supporting the GOP, but I think you laid it out brilliantly, and these folks who can't fathom why the change is taking place, I think it's fair to say they're going to be swept up by the whirlwind of that change when they see how various races, which might have been thought to be safely Democratic, wind up more competitive than some would imagine, or Maybe some of them will even go to the GOP as the years pass. Who knows? But very interesting stuff indeed. No two ways about that. And I think that American politics on the whole are going through a realignment. I mean, there's no question they are, but it's the sort of thing that takes decades, let alone years. You may even argue generations, but the realignment is not going to stop anytime soon. All this brings up an interesting question. Of Democrats who traditionally say that Republicans are the party of the rich. Nowadays, typically some of the wealthiest areas in the U.S. vote Democratic more often than not. And some of the places that are not what you would consider to be traditionally Republican leaning, very working class areas, maybe even poor areas, wind up supporting the GOP. What does this tell you, Keith, about the transformation taking place?
Well, this is really interesting because right now what we're seeing is the growth of divisions within the elite itself, including class divisions along socioeconomic lines. If we look at class voting patterns, and not just voting patterns, but also in terms of the kinds of interests that back different political candidates and political parties and things like that, we see at present that the super rich are much more likely to vote for the support the Democratic Party. We also see that the newly rich are on average more likely to support the Democratic Party, whereas the kinds of business interests, financial interests, commercial interests that lean Republican are often more likely to be more medium level interests, like, for example, more medium-sized business corporations, certainly small business owners, people who own more localized businesses. Those people are much more likely to be Republican. I would imagine that most of the tech oligarchs, the ones who own the big tech companies, not that I've polled them, so this is an unscientific opinion, but my guess would be most of them are Democrats. Now, Elon Musk seems to have moved rightward, in more recent times. But my guess is, the Zuckerbergs, the Gateses, all of these kinds of people, your newly rich people who are have made their money in the tech industry or something similar, like the mass media. For example, somebody like Oprah Winfrey. Most of those people tend to be Democrats or Democratic Party leaning. And also, it seems to be true that the traditional Northeastern establishment in the United States, like for historically the ruling class or whatever you wanted to call it, the elite in the United States tended to be based in the Northeast. And in fact, we could argue that at one point the Northeastern establishment really controlled both of the political parties ultimately. I know when I was a kid, I grew up in conservative circles, and I used to hear a lot of complaints about the Northeastern establishment, and as well as the Rockefellers and families like that, super elite families and business interests and economic interests that were manifestations of the establishment. But most of those kinds of interests today are more likely to lean towards the Democratic Party. Whereas the Republicans, I think, for a long time have represented the Sun Belt. In fact, the post-war conservative movement, I think, was largely Sun Belt oriented, in the sense of industries that were developing in the Sun Belt, a lot of defense contractor related interests, for example. And increasingly, I think the Republican Party, again, it represents small business, medium-sized company. For instance, while a Mark Zuckerberg type might be a Democrat, or Bill Gates might be a Democrat, or a Warren Buffett might be a Democrat, somebody that owns a chain of car dealerships, at a more local level or state level or something like that, would more likely be a Republican. So Michael Lind, who is an analyst who talks about this, he calls it the conflict between the big rich and the lesser rich. That is, the big rich are more likely to be Democrats. The lesser rich are more likely to be Republicans. Caleb Maupin, a journalist for Russia Today, who's a Marxist, he talks about this as well. He talks about how the upper levels of capital tend to be more Democratic Party oriented, whereas the lower levels of capital tend to be more Republican Party oriented. So there's this idea that, you know, Democrats are the party of the working class and the poor, and the Republicans are somehow the party of the affluent and wealthy. A case could be made that that was true in the past. I think even then it was problematic. It was more complex than that. But I don't think that's the case now. In fact, if anything, if we want to use class position and income level as a predictor for, say, how someone is going to vote, if someone is poor or working class, it's greater chance they're probably going to vote Republican. If they're affluent or upper class, they're probably going to, the greater chance they're going to vote Democrat. Now, there are obviously many, many, many people who are exceptions to this general pattern. But when you're talking about these things, you have to go with the law of averages. And research has been conducted by some researchers and social scientists and others. For example, Bill Bishop indicates this. They indicate that increasingly Republicans are the party of the majority of the poor and working class, whereas Democrats are the party of the majority of the affluent and wealthy. Not to say that there's not a minority of people on each side who are not that, but that's the general averages that are now working out. So it's a much different type of situation than what we've seen, say, even 20 years ago when the original article by Teixeira and Judas, or the original work by Teixeira and Judas was published. We've even seen that among prominent individuals. Like, for example, I know in recent years, since Donald Trump came along and became the leader of the Republican Party, we've seen a lot of people who were once locked in Republicans seemingly move over to the Democratic side. Like one prominent example is George Will. George Will, for decades, was a prominent journalist, pundit, commentator, and he was basically known as Mr. Republican. I mean, if there was anybody you could count on to, you know, favor the Republicans, it would have been George Will. But now George Will has, I don't know, formally or informally, but he, for all practical purposes, he's become a Democrat. We've seen the same thing with Bill Kristol. You know, if Bill Kristol is a leading neoconservative, he was a former chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle back in the late 80s or early 90s. He was always a staunch Republican as well. He's actually gone over to the Democratic side. Now, even someone like John Bolton, a super hawk, you know, the old Ronald Reagan Republican, we now see him as a regular figure on MSNBC. So he's maybe not personally a Democrat now, but he might as well be. And the same is true with Liz Cheney. I mean, the Cheneys are Republican royalty. And yet we see Liz Cheney becoming a functional Democrat, you know, in action, if not in name. So that's a really interesting political realignment we see going on there. At the same time, we do see more and more working class people becoming Republican. We do see more and more minorities becoming Republican, even young people in unexpected ways.
I just have to bring up something about Liz Cheney, because her generally favorable reception among Democrats today, and left-leaning independents who typically vote Democratic, it comes at the same time that George W. Bush is viewed more favorably by Democrats and Democratic-leaning voters than he is by Republicans and GOP-leaning voters. So this presents a really important question, because as you surely remember, back during the 2000s, George W. Bush was Satan for the Democrats. They would spit upon the ground where he walked. And the idea that they would ever embrace him, or absolutely not, the idea that they would embrace Dick Cheney or his daughter, I mean, these ideas were just totally out there, you know, bonkers. Tinfoil hat and a black helicopter level nutcrackery. But nowadays, you do see this favorable reception of George W. Bush, Liz Cheney, and even Dick Cheney. They're not saying too many bad things about now. So do you think that they cared ever, these people who were out there saying things about Bush and the Cheneys, and now they embrace these people. Do you think they ever really cared about these causes, or do you think they just decided to do a 180, or do you think it's something else? What do you think is going on here? Because it is absolutely stunning that these folks who were absolutely reviled a short, relatively short time ago, inside, well inside of two decades, now are champions by the so-called left.
Well, I think some of it has to do with changes in party affiliation, and there are precedents for this. For instance, when the Ronald Reagan conservatives took over the Republican Party, there were people who were previously could be considered liberal Republicans who either formally or informally went over to the Democrats. For instance, when I was younger, there was a lot of liberal Republicans. There was a guy named Lowell Weicker from Connecticut who was very liberal. And today, the idea that a guy like that could be a Republican would be unthinkable. And there were many other examples, too. So I think that a lot of the liberal Republicans basically went over to the Democrats. And I think in some degree, that's how we got the Bill Clinton type Democrats. I think that Bill Clinton's idea of moving the Democratic Party to the center, away from the old McGovernite, 1970s era Democratic left, I think that attracted a lot of liberal Republicans, basically liberal Republicans who reinvented themselves as Democrats. And I think that Donald Trump has had a similar effect as Ronald Reagan, in the sense that as Donald Trump has taken over the Republican Party, a lot of former Republicans who might have voted for, say, Ronald Reagan or the Bushes have gone over to the Democrats, again, either formally or informally. And I gave a few examples just a moment ago of, Bill Kristol and George Will and people like that, people who were once solid Republicans. So I think that the rise of Trump has sort of had the effect of Republicanizing the Democratic Party, because you have defectors from the Republican Party going over to the Democrats. At the same time, you have sectors of the Democratic Party who are moving further leftward because due to some of the changes I've been talking about, the cultural, demographic, and generational changes. And that's why today the Democrats, I think, are the largest of the two parties. And one of the problems the Democrats have internally is that they have a much larger array of interests that they represent. So they have to appease all these different types of interests and try to keep everyone happy. So you've got people in the Democratic Party today who are essentially Ronald Reagan Republicans, or could be, all the way over to people who were increasingly further to the left, who represent the more academic left and some of that kind of stuff, the kinds of politics you find in university humanities departments and that kind of stuff and beyond. So that's a pretty broad coalition. But it's also true that I think one of the effects of Trump is that it has revived certain Republican-oriented traditions that were perhaps dormant in American political culture or had been since 1980. For instance, elements of Trumpism, for lack of a better term, are fairly similar to the old style, Nelson Rockefeller, Richard Nixon type of populism. It's not like a far left type of populism, obviously, but it's not really strict right wing populism either. It's sort of a centrist, maybe center right type of populism. I think Trump appeals to some of that same kind of sentiment. One of the effects of Trumpism seems to be that more isolationist type of conservatism, like the Robert Taft type of Republicanism, has made a comeback. And you see that with somebody like, say, Rand Paul. Also the type of interwar conservatism, like the kind of conservatism we had in the United States that sometimes today is called the old right, which also tended to be fairly isolationist in foreign policy, big on protective tariffs, not quite as free market oriented, but also oriented towards kind of the main street, small town chamber of commerce types, your Calvin Coolidge and Warren Harding, Herbert Hoover type of conservatism we started to see elements of that making a comeback. The Teddy Roosevelt I guess you could say it's a type of almost progressive conservatism. You see that with, you know, it was within sectors of the Republican side that are big on denouncing, you know, big business, like a Tucker Carlson perspective, or maybe even a J.D. Vance, some of those kinds of guys who, you know, seem to be in that vein, at least partially. Also, the going back old further than that, in the 19th century, you had a tradition called the Know-Nothings, but this was a type of nativist Americanism that tended to be suspicious of immigration and foreign religions, very Protestant-oriented. You see that to some degree with the anti-immigration movement or with suspicion of, say, Islam or some of these things. The Trumpism has had the effect of reviving all of these kinds of older forms of conservatism, republicanism, things like that, in a way that the more Ronald Reagan, you know, big business, you know, free market, free trade type of conservatives are not really that comfortable with. And you know, now that the neoliberals tend to be the dominant faction in the Democratic Party, and also that you have the more neoliberal hawks on foreign policy largely in charge, your Hillary Clinton types, I think a lot of people who would have been Ronald Reagan conservatives at one point have gone over to the Democratic side. And they tend to look at the Trump movement or all the different elements that tend to most strongly support Trump. They look at those as being more plebeian or proletarian, or, you know, if you're a staunch free market economist, you'd probably even say socialist or maybe protectionist would be a better term. If you're a neocon, you'd object to the isolationism of some of those sectors. So that seems to be what's happening there.
It's fascinating. There's definitely a massive shift taking place, and no doubt shall continue to. Keith, as we unfortunately wind things down tonight, great conversation as always, just had to throw that out there. But as we do wind things down, what do you think will happen this year with working class minorities? Do you think that because it looks very close in polling now, shockingly close, not like this group is about to be just as strongly supportive of Trump as white working class voters are, but there is basically 40%+ of the working class minority electorate that is supportive of Trump. Just really amazing stuff. So do you believe that this will actually materialize on Election Day? What do you think will happen?
Well, there's a lot of different wild cards in this upcoming election that usually aren't there. One of them is the fact that there's going to be an increased number of independent and third party candidates. Probably the most significant of those is going to be Robert Kennedy, also Cornel West. Of course, we've got the Green Party, the Libertarian Party. And because there's so much dissatisfaction with the two major party candidates, I suspect that there's a good chance the minor parties or independents might have an unusually high showing in terms of the amount of votes they're able to receive. Now, it's depending on how that goes, that could really make a difference as far as the electoral contest between the two parties. I mean, I don't think, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is going to get elected president or anything like that. But I do think that the minor parties could have the effect of throwing the election to one candidate or another. My guess is they would probably hurt the Democrats worse than the Republicans. I think that if the minor parties have an impact this year, they're going to probably hurt the Democrats worse than Republicans. And that means that Trump, who presumably is going to be the Republican candidate, would be the winner. So, which would be unusual. I believe there's only been one time in American history where a president was out of office for a term mm-hmm. and then got reelected again. Was that Grover Cleveland?
Cleveland, yep.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, I think the minor parties are something of a wild card that's somewhat unusual. Another thing is this movement from the left and among the Arab and Muslim community to withhold votes for the Democrats over the Israel-Palestine conflict that's going on right now. That could be very damaging to the Democrats because a lot of voting of that type is located in swing states like Michigan. And if the loss of those votes were to cost the Democrats a state like Michigan, that could cost them the election in the Electoral College. So that's another wild card. Also, the fact that you have all of these different court cases against Donald Trump. I mean, they're trying to, you know, basically keep him from being reelected by, you know, hamstringing him with legal cases. You know, depending on how those go, that could those cases could actually strengthen Trump's position, or they could hurt him. Many people may look at it like, well, do we really want to have a president who's, you know, spends most of his time going to court? You know, shouldn't we have a president who's not distracted with all of these things? On the other hand, there's some evidence that many of these court cases that have been brought against Trump have actually strengthened his position, because a lot of people think that he's being railroaded, or they, you know, and because the political establishment is so unpopular, many people think, well, a person that's that hated by the establishment couldn't be all bad. So it's, the evidence seems to indicate that some of those cases may be helping Trump's general popularity. So, you know, all of these are variables and wild cards that are going to impact what happens on election day. Another thing is whether Biden himself even remains in the race. Do the Democrats have some kind of plan to replace him at the last minute with, say, Gavin Newsom or Kamala Harris or somebody like that? You know, will Trump make it to the finish line as far as the election, or, you know, they're going to end up putting him in jail or something like that? Although he could still theoretically run for president from jail, does the Eugene V. Debs, the Socialist Party leader, did that, I believe, back in 1916 or 1918, somewhere in there. So it's really hard to say how the election's going to turn out. If I had to bet on how it's going to turn out, I would bet that Trump probably wins, although he probably will win in the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. It might very well be a repeat of 2016, which is, that's what happened that time. And if, you know, if I was going to, you know, make a bet on it, like, with odds makers or whatever, that's probably what I would bet on, that Trump wins in the Electoral College, but not in the popular vote. Now, something happens and Trump is somehow replaced as the Republican candidate at the last minute or somewhere down the line. I actually think another Republican may actually do better than Trump, because that person would not be lacking some of the disabilities that Trump has, like being hamstrung with court cases and stuff like that. I've seen some evidence of that, that another Republican might actually beat Biden and have a better chance of doing better than Trump as well. And of course, if the Democrats were to replace Biden, I don't know if they're going to do that, but if they did, that would be a whole new ball game. You know, as to whether, you know, Gavin Newsom, say, could beat Trump in a general election, it's something of a toss-up. I think Newsom or somebody comparable would go over better with more moderate voters. I don't know that, you know, the left-wing Democrats would care one way or the other. I think that most of those are going to vote Democrat no matter what, except for those that go to third-party candidates. So it's, you know, it's one of those kinds of things where there's so many different variables. It's really hard to say how it's going to turn out.
We will definitely see what happens. That much can be said for certain. Keith, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. It's been a great conversation as always. I very much look forward to having you back on. I could think of a few things that we would discuss. So this year is going to throw so many curveballs in the direction of so many people that there will be stuff for absolute certain.
Definitely.
Absolutely. And everyone, thank you very much for having tuned in. I hope you got as much out of this discussion as Keith and I did. In any case, stay safe, be well, and cheers.